Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter arrived in Iraq's Kurdistan Sunday to review the ongoing military offensive to retake Mosul. As the Pentagon chief went into talks with the Kurdish leader Masoud Barzani, U.S. officials say Kurdish Peshmerga forces had almost reached their goals in the week-old offensive. The battle plan is for the Peshmerga forces to stop along a line at an average of 20 kilometers outside the city of Mosul. Meanwhile, Pope Francis Sunday appealed for peace in Iraq, saying violence in the country had left him speechless. Conducting his weekly Angelus prayer from the window of the papal apartments overlooking St. Peter's Square, Francis said his thoughts were particularly with the inhabitants of Mosul. He says, "Our souls are shocked by the brutal acts of violence that for too long are being committed against innocent citizens." The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported heavy clashes and airstrikes that shook the Syrian city of Aleppo Sunday. It comes as heavy fighting resumed after the end of a three-day truce declared by government ally Russia. Thousands of Cameroonians have flocked to hospitals in the country's two main cities Sunday. They are searching for corpses and survivors after an overloaded train derailed on Friday, injuring more than 600 and killing more than 70. Most of the victims are now receiving treatment in the hospitals in the capital of Yaounde and the port city of Douala. It came after rail lines were cleared and the injured were evacuated. The accident happened in Eska. This is VOA News. The pro-government Arab coalition Sunday stepped up airstrikes on Iran-backed rebels in Yemen, and clashes raged on the ground. Warring parties ignored a UN call to renew a fragile ceasefire. The 72-hour ceasefire took effect just before midnight on Wednesday to allow aid deliveries in Yemen. It officially ended at midnight on Saturday. The United States is warning U.S. citizens of the potential risk of terror attack or attempted kidnapping of foreigners in Istanbul, Turkey. The consulate on its website said in a message late Saturday that extremist groups continued their aggressive attacks to attack Americans and other foreigners in the city. The notice went on to say that the attacks may be pre-planned or could occur with little or no warning. At least 172 inmates escaped a Haitian prison near the capital of Port-au-Prince during an armed mutiny, killing one guard. Many escaped with police weapons, according to local media. One prisoner climbed over a wall and fell to his death, while two other detainees were wounded and are in hospital. The European Union and Canada will decide on Monday whether they will meet for a summit Thursday held to sign the CETA trade pact, according to a European source. Tomorrow afternoon, the president of the European Council, Donald Tusk, will have a phone conversation with the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. Italian officials say 14 bodies have been recovered in a two-day period on smugglers' boats packed with migrants making the journey across the Mediterranean. The Italian Coast Guard says the dead included a 25-year-old pregnant woman. In all, 5,700 migrants were rescued from dozens of small boats and rubber dinghies between Friday and Saturday. Fighters from the al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab group said Sunday that they had retaken control of a town in central Somalia. It comes after hundreds of Ethiopian troops serving with the African Union's Amisom force withdrew. It's the third time this month that the Islamist group moved into a town in the region after the departure of Ethiopian forces. An unmanned cargo ship operated by the U.S. company Orbital ATK arrived Sunday at the International Space Station, delivering 2.5 tons of food and supplies for the 6 astronauts living there. That ship will remain attached to the space station until November. Astronauts will fill it up with trash before sending it back to Earth. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Our position is that the commission of inquiry that has been established is a waste of time and it's a waste of government resources.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu appoints a committee to investigate violence associated with the recent general election.
My stomach is spinning, my head is spinning, and I was rushed to the hospital where I went and they asked me questions and they injected me and they sent me to go and see the doctor.
The death toll rises following a train accident outside the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Africans, or South Africans in particular, would be interested in knowing who would become the next U.S. president because, for instance, it could pretty much determine how much aid would be coming to Africa.
And Africans express interest while monitoring election-related activities in the United States. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zambian President Edgar Lungu has appointed a 15-member committee to investigate violence associated with the August 11 general election. He won the presidential vote, although the main opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema from the United Party for National Development, or UPND, disputes the outcome of the poll. The committee was given 120 days to examine the extent to which the pre-election violence could have influenced the voting patterns in the poll. But Charles Kakoma, spokesperson for the UPND, told me that the investigation is unlikely to be credible.
Our position is that the commission of inquiry that has been established is a waste of time and it's a waste of government resources because it's going to spend a lot of money to gather evidence that is already known, evidence that is already in public domain. Early this year, the church mother bodies in Zambia organized a conference to look at the same political violence, and it was established that political violence and that the one who had the final say on how to stop the violence is the president, because he's the one that is in charge of the police, in charge of the army and other security forces, and that he failed to do that, to use his position to stop the violence. And therefore, we have seen a situation where the ruling party cadres are still terrorizing people in bus stops, in markets, in the compounds, and so on and so forth.
Supporters of the PF are saying that UPND is to blame for the violence. And they said Hakainde Hichilema, the leader of the UPND presidential candidate as well in the last general election, has failed to call his people to eschew violence. And that is why the meeting between him and President Lungu to address tension in the country has yet to come on. Your take?
Well, in fact, President Hakainde Hichilema must be credited for the peace and calmness that is existing now in Zambia, because after the election, which he believed was stolen from him, he appealed to the Zambian people to remain calm. And that is why we do not see serious post-election violence, fights on the streets did not take place. So for them not to appreciate that stance, is being hypocritical, and that is why we think they are trying to make this commission of inquiry in order to absolve themselves from blame.
Well, I remember President Lungu, before the election was over, called on Hakainde Hichilema to renounce violence for a meeting to be organized between Hakainde Hichilema and the president. And Hakainde Hichilema has yet to do so. Why hasn't Hakainde Hichilema done this? Of course, some supporters of the PF are saying the move to constitute a panel to investigate this shows President Lungu's commitment to end violence in the country.
Well, Hakainde Hichilema is a victim of violence itself. So he cannot be expected to renounce violence when he is a victim. In the recent past, in the run-up to the elections, the ruling party organized their supporters to go and stone or bring down the helicopter, his campaign helicopter, and even that of his running mate. They also organized the people to bring down the helicopter. And we have seen PF cadres, the ruling party cadres, going to storm an international airport in order to inflict harm on the, because an opposition leader was on that aircraft. The list is endless.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesperson for the Zambian Opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Former Ghanaian First Lady and Opposition National Democratic Party, or NDP, presidential candidate Nana Kunedu Ajimah Rawlings says she has what it takes to win the upcoming December 7 presidential poll. The Electoral Commission disqualified her and 12 other presidential candidates for failing to meet requirements. In part two of my interview with Mrs. Rawlings, she tells me why she is the most qualified candidate for the highest office in the land.
Partisan politics means partisan politics. And then when you get to certain levels and you take a decision to go into an alliance, you look at who has the best interest of Ghanaians at heart. And definitely if you want to join those people, there's nothing wrong with it. So that will depend on my party executives. It will depend on our party structure, on what we want to do. I'm not going to take a decision on my own and say I am on X side or white side. That is not what will be done.
Some Ghanaians that I spoke with said you are to blame for contributing to the setting up of the structures of the National Democratic Congress in this instance, and that every ill that this party has committed against Ghanaians should be at your doorstep because you are an architect of it. So coming out and criticizing them basically is, they said, you should look yourself in the mirror. What do you say to that?
You know something, you can set up a company with all good intentions and bring in very bad managers who, honestly, Peter, those people will collapse the company. And I guess you, as the one who set up the company, should take the full responsibility, right? We were the ones who set up the party. But today, there were people in the National Convention Party who today have taken the NDC over. Most of them are who they call themselves Nkrumahs. They are not people who believe in what President Rawlings decided on. So they are doing things at variance with what we believe in. So indeed, if things have changed, I do not think that you can blame me for things changing. You know that I went into the National Executive hoping that I'll be able to help correct things in the party. But it was not to be.
Some political analysts are saying you have put your husband in a very awkward position, a dilemma, if you want, that he is the founder of the National Democratic Congress, and yet you have formed your own party, the NDP. Why did you do such?
Well, as I said earlier, the party had lost its way in the sense that all the objectives that we used in setting up the party had been thrown completely out. Conditions that made us set up the party so that we use probity, accountability, power to the people, letting people get empowered, explaining the situation all the time to Ghanaians so that they actually know what is going on in their governance was thrown out so that nobody has a right to question what government is doing. Now, in the course of this, a whole lot of things happened, and really, I think I've spoken to DOA about some of them, so it's water under the bridge. But the important thing that I would like to say is that it was clear, as he himself said, to set up a new party that would give credibility and give Ghanaians who want some honesty in partisan politics an avenue to enter partisan politics with honesty. So it's not something that has been done to disgrace him or anything like that. But most importantly, let me just say that as a political being, I come from a family that has different disciplines of politics all in the same house. My father has about 50-something brothers and sisters. One third of them are CPP, another third UP, another group, you know, they are either not interested or they flip-flop from one to the other. But everything that we discuss in my father's house, or my father will discuss with his brothers and sisters, and family friends who come around, is based on, was it right or was it wrong? It's never this party or that party. At the end of the day, if they are doing something in one party and he thinks that the objective is good, he praises them for it, even though he himself tried to stay neutral. So I come from a family where partisan politics has always been played, and indeed all parties also exist in the home.
Some Ghanaians are saying that your appeal on the ground is very limited and that your realistic chances of winning a possible presidential election, even if you win the court case and your candidacy is restored and you are able to participate in the December 7th presidential election, your chances realistically of winning the presidency is almost zero to none. What do you say to that?
Actually, they don't really know the ground situation. I have been going around, and I can tell you my chances are very, very good. That is why the Electoral Commission finds it necessary to do what she's done. Because one subscriber on some page, 89, as she put it, of my nomination, is not a valid registered voter, and therefore she illegally took me out, when what she should have done was to have asked me to come and correct it. Because for each place that we went to, we made sure that we had more than three names, so that in case of anything, there's something that we can change the names with.
Nana Kunedu Ajuma Rawlings is a former Ghanaian First Lady and presidential candidate of the opposition National Democratic Party, or NDP. She spoke with me from the capital, Accra. The death toll has risen to 73 after a train derailed and crashed Friday outside the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. Hundreds more were injured. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka was at the scene and has this report.
The Njogluk family mourns the death of their 54-year-old mother near the train station in Eseka. She was traveling for a funeral service in Cameroon's economic capital, Douala, when the train derailed and she died. Their daughter, Patience Atnanga, who was traveling alongside the family of seven, says she was rushed to the hospital.
My stomach is spinning, my head is spinning, and I was rushed to the hospital where I went and they asked me questions and they injected me and they sent me to go and see the doctor and she sent me to go and do some tests. And when I did the test, but the results are not out.
21-year-old Alvin Batamo was rushed to the psychiatric unit of the Eseka Hospital, where doctors said her situation was stable. She told VOA what she remembers about the accident.
J'ai eu l'impression que je volais comme un oiseau. Donc le train est tombé et tout de suite avec.
She says when the train started crashing, she had an impression she was flying from one corner of the rail car to another like a bird. She says almost everyone was shouting the name of Jesus and crying for help. Businessman Atanga Martin says while in the train, he observed that the brake system may have been faulty.
Au niveau de l'engouement, bon, on a ressenti une odeur de garniture, du frein. Oui.
Bon, he says they noticed that the brake system on the train was faulty because of the strong smell emanating from the locomotive. He says although they were worried because the train was in stop speed, they had no one to complain to until they found themselves in bushes near the rail line. There has been no official cause given for the wreck. Cameroon's Minister of Transport, Edgar Aleme Bengo, alongside six other government ministers, visited the accident site. Mebengo says 53 people died and 600 were wounded, yet the hospital has only a capacity of 60 beds. He says they have ordered the victims to be transported from the Eseka hospital, which is overwhelmed.
Je voudrais saisir cette occasion pour demander à tous les acteurs sur le terrain de redoubler d'efforts.
He says he is calling on everyone to double efforts to save the lives of the injured and calling on railway authorities to help them evacuate patients and save lives. The train crashed between Yaoundé and Douala while carrying about 1,300 passengers. It normally carries 600, but the number of their clients increased when some culverts on the only route linking Yaoundé and Douala sank as a result of a landslide following heavy rains. Railway officials said they increased the number of cars from 8 to 18 to cope with the huge number of customers, but the 30-year-old rail line apparently could not carry the heavy load. Cameroon government spokesperson Issa Chiruma says the government has ordered investigations to probe the circumstances that led to the accident.
En ce moment difficile pour la nation, le président de la République adresse ses condoléances les plus attristées aux familles ainsi éprouvées et souhaite un prompt rétablissement aux blessés.
He says President Paul Biya is extending a message of condolence to the bereaved families and encouraging the wounded during this very difficult moment Cameroon is facing. He says the president has asked the government to assist all victims with whatever they need for their treatment. He says investigations have been opened to determine the causes of the accident. It is feared the death toll may increase. Rescue workers are still digging through the rubble in search of survivors and bodies. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
There's little more than 2.5 weeks left before Americans go to the polls to choose President Barack Obama's successor. The campaign has been a stormy one between Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton. Last week, they completed their third and final televised debate. Tinashe Chuchu is a political science lecturer at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. Viewer William Eagle asked him why U.S. elections are important to Africa.
Africans, or South Africans in particular, would be interested in knowing who would become the next U.S. president because, for instance, it could pretty much determine how much aid would be coming to Africa. For instance, there's a time that President George W. Bush allocated about $15 billion to at least help relieve AIDS in Africa. And right now, you find foundations like the Clinton Foundation contribute so much in terms of AIDS relief, malaria, natural disasters that happen in Africa. And I'm not speaking for everyone, but I think Africans in particular are very interested in immigration policies because Africa has a lot of problems in general, not to pinpoint any particular African country, but a lot of Africans seek greener pastures in America, and people in Africa feel that a Trump presidency might make it difficult, if not impossible, to get into the States. So you find that it's for two reasons, to see how much aid would come to Africa, as well as the potential of relocating or seeking better opportunities in America. That's why I think Africans would be interested in the next U.S. president.
Many critics say that the tone of the debates have been marked by negativity. There's been a lot of personal insults in the Republican primaries and in the debates. Is that common in an African context?
In African politics, violence is also the norm. Voter suppression is also the norm. And even In terms of media, you find that there is no freedom of the press. Most African countries rely on state media, and this is quite strange. I think the Trump rallies will go into history as one of the few, if not the only, American presidential rallies that had violence.
A large part of the campaign cycle has focused on the character of the candidates and which one would have a more suitable temperament to lead the government. Both candidates have questioned each other's honesty, for example. In African campaigns, is that an issue for choosing a national leader?
Within an African context, in terms of presidential candidates' temperament, you find that people really don't even look at that because we don't have, for instance, nuclear weapons. So there isn't going to be a catastrophe where you get a crazy person elected and that person destroys the whole continent. You can't have an unstable person running the U.S. because that person could obliterate the whole world with nuclear weapons. But in Africa, how much damage could a crazy person make? But I think temperament across the board is important. But in Africa, people want to look for someone who's brave, someone who's willing to speak truth to power.
Some Americans believe that that's what Donald Trump does. Do many Africans support Mr. Trump? Do they see him as the sort of a leader that could get things done?
Most of the people who like Trump in Africa are people who have a problem with other racial groups. The largest white group in South Africa, they're called Afrikaans. They are Dutch immigrants. They actually have a problem with black South Africans, not necessarily black people from other countries. And they feel like they are a minority that might cease to exist. So my point is that the people who like Trump, they like him for sort of the negative things that he's known for.
Tinashe Chuchu is a political science lecturer at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. He spoke with my colleague William Eagle. Some South Sudanese students studying in Uganda have devised unique ways to survive the economic hardships they face. For VOA, Mugume Davis Rakarinji takes a look at one South Sudanese in the Ugandan capital Kampala who has set up a business that helps him earn money as well as employ his fellow South Sudanese.
Every evening after classes, 25-year-old George Wani, a second-year student at Kampala International University, rushes to his business in Soyabunga, a Kampala suburb. He must keep cooking utensils clean as he waits for customers. It is a newly acquired profession. Before South Sudan conflict broke out in December 2013, Wani's parents paid his school fees and provided for his other needs. But the fighting affected his parents' business and they could no longer pay school fees for Wani or his siblings who also study in Kampala. Wani says he had to sell the family car in order to pay school fees and meet other expenses. Wani decided to open a restaurant.
Then I remained with some money. Then I'm said, if I keep this money, I'm going to eat it. Let me do something with it. Now I have started a small business here, like a restaurant, for Sudanese restaurant. Even some Ugandans and Congolese, they can come. Now the thing is going somehow good.
The South Sudanese pound has continued to lose value against the US dollar ever since violence broke out in Juba and spread to other parts of the country. One US dollar now exchanges for more than 70 South Sudanese pounds on the black market. When he says his parents cannot afford to raise enough pounds to buy dollars on the black market to pay school fees for him and his young brother, who is also a student at Kampala International University.
If I wait for all the money to come from there for school fees and for the rent and for everything, it becomes difficult.
When his restaurant, Kodrom Shell, employs 7 South Sudanese, including Monitek Majak, an information technology student at Kampala University. Majak says his parents can only manage to pay school fees, so he has to make ends meet from his part-time job at Romshare restaurant.
Those who used to support us have stopped recently from providing what was needed. This business right here is providing, you know, those small things.
Wadang Ador, a final year law student at the Kampala-based Cavendish University, is a regular customer at the restaurant. He says Romshare is a new home for him in Kampala.
It seems to be like part and parcel of our cultures, uniting ourselves and being under one umbrella, actually.
Ador says he believes when young South Sudanese like himself finish their studies, they'll be able to find jobs back home and participate in making decisions to determine the future of their country. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sport. Ivory Coast will start the defense of the Africa Cup of Nations against Togo in January. That's according to the draw made in Libreville on Wednesday. Ivory Coast, who beat Ghana on penalties in the 2015 final, are in Group C against Togo, Morocco, and DR Congo. The hosts appear to have been fortunate in the draw. They are pitched in Group A alongside Guinea-Bissau, Cameroon, and Burkina Faso. Gabon will stage the opening match in Libreville on January 14th against Guinea-Bissau, who make their first appearance in the 16-nation tournament. The other group favorites, Algeria and Ghana, start against Zimbabwe and Uganda, respectively. Egypt, Ghana, and Uganda have also been drawn together for the Nations Cup, as well as a World Cup qualifying group. Algeria have the toughest first round in Group B, where they also take on Tunisia and Senegal for one of the two qualifying places for the quarterfinals. Ghana are the team to beat in Group D. Apart from Uganda, they will take on Egypt, making their return to the contest after missing the three finals and Mali. Seven-time African champions Egypt will be eager to revive their dominance after some years of underperforming, while Ghana are desperate to win the first title since 1982. Uganda's last appearance at the tournament was in 1978, when they lost in the final to Ghana. Elsewhere is the final match in the African Champions League. Egyptian club Zamalek takes on Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa tonight. The Egyptian club have won the title five times before, but not been in a final for 14 years. They were handed a 3-0 drubbing in Atteridgeville in the first leg and have a mountain to climb if they are to emerge as the new continental champions. Over 50,000 Zamalek fans are expected to storm the 86,000-seater Borg Al Arab Stadium, about 20 kilometers outside Egypt's second-largest city, Alexandria. At stake for the winner, the 2016 CAF Champions League, is $1.5 million prize money and the ticket to represent Africa at the FIFA Club World Cup in December in Japan. And the selection process to choose the 2016 World Athletes of the Year is underway. The winner will be announced at the IAAF Athletics Awards 2016 in Monaco on Friday, December 2nd. This year's 10 men's nominees was selected by an international panel of athletics experts comprising representatives from all six continental areas of the IAAF. And they are Usain Bolt of Jamaica for sprints. Bolt is Olympic champion at 100 meters, 200 meters, and 4x100 meters. And he's unbeaten at all distances, including preliminaries. Thiago Braz of Brazil is for pole vault. Ashton Eaton of USA is for combined events. Mo Farah of Great Britain for long distance. Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya is nominated for marathon. He's Olympic champion and London Marathon winner, and he also won the World Marathon Majors. Conselas Kipruto of Kenya also is nominated for 3,000 steeplechase. Omar McLeod of Jamaica for 110 hurdles. David Rudisha of Kenya for 800 meters. Christian Taylor of USA for triple jump. And Wyatt Van Niekerk of South Africa for 400 meters. He's the Olympic champion with a world record of 43.03 seconds. The women nominees are Almaz Ayan of Ethiopia for distance, Ruth Beshia of Spain for high jump, Vivian Chiruyot of Kenya for distance, Kendra Harrison of USA for 100 meters hurdles, Catherine Ibaguen of Colombia for triple jump, Ruth Jebet of Bahrain for 3,000 meters steeplechase, Sandra Pekovic of Croatia for discus, Kasta Semenya of South Africa for 800 meters, Elaine Thompson of Jamaica for sprints, and Anita Waldakaisk of Poland for hammer. Voting closes on November 1st, and at the conclusion of the voting process, a 3 men and 3 women finalists will be announced by the IAAF. The male and female World Athletes of the Year will be announced live on stage at the IAAF Athletics Awards 2016. And that's it for this edition of Netherlands Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Girl, I'm drowning in your love. Yeah. So baby, take it all. I know with you no turning back. Girl, I said it all. I don't care what people say about you. Don't care if they must spoil you from you. Because I told you before that I wanna go far with you. Doubting I fit mess up to Asami Mabu Shuma to Rubelumi Manoko. Oh, no, go to Roma, no. Go jump over, check, go nowhere. And if I want a baby from you, give me one. No fear, fear. This is for real. No go grief another man, body wow, baby. No go chop another woman, no how. Feeling I'm feeling for you, baby, is awakening my soul. I will love you till nobody else see what they won't do for you. Why? Yeah, you no go regret. Nothing go make me forget. Only you are no good to share. Cause a good la la bakuwa. I told you before that I wanna go far with you. Doubting I fit mess up to Hasami Nabu. Show my girl, me my love. Oh, no, go to Roma, no. Go nowhere. And if I want a baby from you, give me one. No fear, fear. Baby, okay, I just want you to know.
Jumbo, jumbo, I don't get so good.
no more. Amaka, you know, oh. Come on, Yoruba, let me go. If your papa no want us to marry, your woman, no, you know. No, girl, I'm down for you, don't forget. The love me, I get it for you. Mama, no go compare. Be myself, be myself. Where I was. Baby broke as long as you love me. Girl, I dare ya. Girl, I dare ya. Girl, I dare ya. Girl, I dare ya. Girl, I no one wrong. But then your father is violent. Oleri, oleri. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. Oleri, you define that you. Your mother is black dot. She's a big character. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. I bet no better. Your father is violent. Oh, let me tell you. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. We'll be fine, mommy. Your mother is black belt. She's a big character. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. I don't get so no more.
Oh, I feel my boots are saving. What you want? Yeah, 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 yeah. says she don't want me to go. She says I always make her day. Girl, would you be my lover? No. She says she really likes my style. Seems like she wants to take it slow. Do anything to make her smile. Girl, would you be my lover? No. What am I to do? Tired of running around chasing you. I can never think of replacing you. Cause now you are defined, baby, make up your mind. Hey, would you be my lover? Or love for four. This guy is feeling it in my soul. So would you be my lover? No. I'm doing things I've never done. I'm giving all I have to give. I'm feeling like I found the one. Say you'll be my lover, please. What am I to say? Tired of running around, no delay. Make you no go look who Jay Faye. All this time you there waste, you gon' make me crazy. Would you be my lover? Catchy cruise. Wanna know if you go do. I got one question for you. Are you gonna let me be the one? Are you gonna let me be the one? Are you gonna let me be the one? Baby, oh.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The turbulent and difficult relationship between the International Criminal Court and the African continent took an interesting turn last week when two African states took decisions that will, within a year, result in their departure from the ICC. One may disagree with the motivation of Burundi and South Africa to depart from the ICC, but there should be common agreement that their decisions may once and for all demonstrate that the African continent should no longer be seen as a toothless bulldog. For years now, the African Union and many African states have criticized the inordinate focus of the ICC on the African continent. Whenever decisions have been made by the African Union that African states should not cooperate with the ICC, or African states who have talked about the bias of the ICC did talk around the officials of the ICC and the supporters around the globe, is this is just African talk and politics. But this is not African talk and politics. The history of the ICC has shown that they have looked on the African continent as an experiment. Yes, the first head of state to be indicted and issued with an arrest warrant has been an African state, Sudan. The first person to be indicted for abuse of the witness system has been an African down the road. So Africans should take decisions that will make the International Criminal Court show some degree of respect for the opinion of the African states. Now, the reason is simple. This commentator has made over and over again the assessment that because as in the 19th century, when the Ottoman Empire was seen as the sick man of Europe, today the African continent is widely seen as the sick man of the international community, which means people are free to kick around the African continent. Let us be very clear. There have been horrible things committed in the African continent, and there are many heads of state and individuals who should be brought before the ICC. But let us be very clear. There are other heads of state, other countries, which are committing atrocities, in part much more than the Africans, but they have never been brought before the ICC. And the reason being, because they are stronger and Africa is very weak. So this decision by Burundi and South Africa may allow the ICC, if they want to change, to recognize that the ICC was brought into being because African states were the most enthusiastic about the setting up of the ICC. They rushed to sign and ratify the Rome Treaty. Others signed but never ratified. And it is even strange that many of the countries that have not ratified are today the enthusiastic support of the ICC, particularly when they drag in African heads of state and African before the ICC. And one may say, well, as they have said, the ICC is headed by an African. That is most irrelevant. That has nothing to do with the important fact for international institutions. International institutions must be international, they must be independent, and they must act impartially. Nothing in the ICC as it comes to the African has shown that they have been impartial. It is very easy and popular to say Africans are corrupt. Yes, they are. That they are brutal. Yes, they are. But what about the others? And we can name them. Why can't the ICC attack those countries as they are attacking the African continent? So therefore, even though there might be Africans who criticize the decision of South Africa and Burundi, and even though there are African states like Botswana who are strong defenders of the ICC, Africans must not forget that the decision of Burundi and South Africa may in the end result in the decent respect for the views of African states. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Cassius Martins, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, there's no difference between a thief and his accomplice. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In October, the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa, or COMESA, launched a five-year Regional Development Objectives Grant Agreement at the 19th COMESA Summit, held this year in Madagascar. The agreement, announced in Nairobi, Kenya, provides for USAID to contribute approximately $77 million to strengthen the collaborative partnership between the two organizations and implement regional trade, investment, and agriculture development programs that contribute to their common goals. U.S. Ambassador to Zambia and Special Representative to COMESA, Eric Schultz, USAID Deputy Mission Director for Kenya and East Africa, Candice Buzzard, and the COMESA Secretary General, Ambassador Sindiso Ngwenya, signed a Memorandum of Understanding to affirm the agreement. Ambassador Schultz pointed to the continued momentum toward achieving common economic development goals by renewing the partnership. Through economic diversification, attracting more foreign investment, and reducing existing trade barriers, we can build upon our successes to date. I am confident that the new agreement will help us bolster growth and unlock economic potential among the COMESA member states. Under this agreement, COMESA and USAID will work together to achieve shared development priorities to promote sustainable regional economic integration, reinforce institutional governance and accountability by supporting the coordination of regional trade, investment, and agricultural policies, and strengthen COMESA's organizational leadership. The new agreement is not the first for USAID and COMESA, a regional economic community under the African Union with 19 member states. They have partnered since 2003 to create sustainable and integrated markets, increase the productivity of staple crops and farm productivity, promote trade and reduce trade barriers in regional markets, and support the free movement of goods and services in the region. Under a previous agreement, USAID provided $115 million to support the organization in delivering its mandate. The United States is proud to work with its partner COMESA to promote the prosperity of Africa and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.